Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham dhammam sangham namasami. Friends, continuing this discourse on the Dhatavibandha Sutta, we are up to the contemplation of consciousness element, and I'm going to read from the sutta tonight regarding the four great elements of materiality plus the space element. One has contemplated them to see them as they actually are. That is to say, this is not mine, I am not this, this is not myself. And having seen with proper wisdom, one has become disenchanted with these objects. And then the sutta says, then there remains only consciousness, purified and bright. What does one cognize with that consciousness? One cognizes, this is pleasant. One cognizes, this is painful. One cognizes, this is neither painful nor pleasant. Independence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, there arises a pleasant feeling. When one feels a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. One understands, with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as pleasant, its corresponding feeling, the pleasant feeling that arose in dependence on the contact to be felt as pleasant, ceases and subsides. Independence on a contact to be felt as painful, there arises a painful feeling. When one feels a painful feeling, one understands, I feel a painful feeling. One understands, with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as painful, its corresponding feeling, the painful feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt as painful, ceases and subsides. Independence on a contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, there arises a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When one feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. One understands, with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, its corresponding feeling, the neither painful nor pleasant feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, ceases and subsides. Bhikkhu, just as from the contact and friction of two fire sticks, heat is generated, and fire is produced, and with the separation and disjunction of these two fire sticks, the corresponding heat ceases and subsides, so too, independence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, and so on. Seeing how the contact arises and ceases, and the corresponding feeling arises and ceases and subsides. Then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy and radiant. Suppose, Bhikkhu, a skilled goldsmith or his apprentice were to prepare a furnace, heat up the crucible, take some gold with tongs and put it into the crucible. From time to time he would blow on it. From time to time he would sprinkle water over it. And from time to time he would just look on. That gold would become refined, well refined, completely refined, faultless, rid of dross, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Then whatever kind of ornament he wished to make from it, whether a golden chain or earrings or a necklace or a golden garland, it would serve his purpose. So too, bhikkhu, then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy and radiant. Friends, based on not this sutta but some other passage, there is an idea among some of the schools of meditation that there is a pure a citta, or a mind, which is floating free or disconnected from the contact with the senses. Separated from the life process, which is based on arising out of a physical or living body and its experience. But in this case, what the Buddha is speaking of here is called vijnana, which is a different word than citta. In some cases, there is a bit of a confusion. They translate it like mano, citta, vijnana, all translates as mind, and sort of smudge them together and say they all mean the same thing. But here, it's very clear in this passage that the vijnana, you could call it the faculty of the mind that has the function of cognizing. Cognizing what? Cognizing what's arising from a contact. Another friend of mine wants to not translate vijnana as consciousness, thinking that that gets into a whole other set of ideas that have arisen in modern times about what consciousness is, but instead translating it as cognition, so that we don't have the feeling that the vijnana is something that goes on, that has a duration of time, but rather that the vijnana is something that's arising and subsiding, and that vijnana, the whole point, almost every time when you see the mention of vijnana, it's mentioned in terms of it, something that has the function of cognizing and has this a strong aspect of impermanence, arising and subsiding based on contact. So the there is a purification of the vijnana, which is described in the metaphor with the equanimity. Where the we see the goldsmith gradually working the ore to purify it of all its imperfections. When vijnana arises, it typically arises together with some other concomitant factors, which are sometimes unskillful, such as a vijnana which is connected with anger, or vijnana connected with desire. And then when the consciousness has an unskillful concomitant factor, then that will strongly influence the type of vedana, the type of feeling that comes from that, and the tendency to evolve into some other kind of mental proliferation. So, one way of experiencing that the problem of liking and disliking in a more subtle way, with when we're inspecting vijnana, is to notice how the mind likes to see some things and doesn't like to see other things. So the vijnana inclines towards certain objects and inclines to miss other objects. But the thing that makes the pure vijnana pure is that the pure vijnana has lost that inclination and is no longer selectively over-focusing on some things and missing other things. Instead, it's a vijnana that doesn't have any preference whatsoever as to what it experiences. It is equally able to experience an object to be experienced as pleasant, an object to be experienced as unpleasant, or an object to be experienced as neutral. And regardless of what color the object is, what is the most prominent characteristic that is common among all of them is the impermanence of seeing the arising and the subsiding. And so then it's for this reason that it's not that a person who has got a purified vijnana becomes omniscient in terms of being able to see everything all the time, but it's purified in the sense of being this aspect of being freed from the blind spots. This is the third unwholesome root is the root of ignorance or delusion. So what is delusion? It's like there's something that's right in front of us, but we don't see it. Why? Because the mind doesn't want to see that. And this happens to beings all the time in daily life, that we become excessively focused on things involved with liking and disliking, and as a result of being excessively focused in one way, we miss other things. So when the consciousness experiences the arising and subsiding of the vedanas, of the feeling, of the moments of feeling, as something that is coming and passing so quickly, then that it loses the appeal, and one becomes one gains that equanimity. So in that sense, um, we can see that the meditation has brought us close to being able to become, to enter the gate of liberation by way of non-craving, by way of dropping that craving, the tanha. So when that our tanha doesn't arise, or when it then that's the, when we experience the third noble truth, the cessation of suffering. There's another aspect of consciousness which is very much emphasized by Western philosophers and scientists, and I don't think it's actually irrelevant to the Dhamma, and that is the idea that it's by way of consciousness that a sentient being establishes a self. And that's actually the very definition of consciousness in philosophy and neuroscience, is that a being which is conscious is a being which is able to recognize that it has a self. That it's able to make the distinction between what belongs to itself and what doesn't belong to itself or belongs outside of itself. And this is something that's very sort of functional, and at certain times you could question whether it's possible to really determine whether another being has consciousness or not, since you can't get inside of them to know what they're experiencing. You can just see their behavior. So if there's a a plant, and the plant is like growing towards the sun, does that mean that the plant has consciousness and wants to live, or likes the sun and likes, you know, or does it mean that it's just a completely blind process that doesn't possess consciousness? See, and so it's not that much of a clear-cut thing, but we know with our own experience that the consciousness in a human being is very much involved with this subject-object duality, that the self is the subject which is experiencing the objects. And we can pretty much tell with other higher animals, it's very obvious when you are interacting with your you know, a pet dog or a mouse or something like that, that you can see it's perfectly clear that they have a very similar kind of consciousness that we have in terms of knowing who they are, and that they have a concern for their own welfare. And even they have a theory of mind, that they're able to distinguish that they have their own self, and that other mice or other monkeys or other people also have their own self, and they're living in society. So this is from the Western perspective. In the Dhamma, this Dhamma is leading towards the idea of a conceiving, that it's leading towards what it is that causes a being to, or causes a person to perpetuate an existence through time, and to have the experience of being trapped in the cycle of samsara going on and on. And this experience of time then is involved with an experience of some kind of a continuity or an impression. We think it's a delusion, but that because we experience that we had this individuality. Even from babies, maybe we had an individuality even before we were born, or even before we were conceived, we might feel intuitively that there was an individuality, and that it goes on through time, and that we're the same person that we were when we were a child or a baby, even though that was a long time ago, and that we have a concern about our future, whether or not we'll be successful in our chosen endeavor, and so we're kind of like projecting this self-fabrication of the self is being projected forward into the future through our own efforts, which can be, even if they're like wholesome and well-intentioned efforts, even if like one would like to become a successful as a monastic and gain stages of awakening or something like that. These can be picked up by the mind in terms of a conception of a projecting yourself into the future. And if we're doing that, then that's how we get to go on and have another life. When the end of this life comes, if the mind is still involved in that work of like self-projection, self-conception, self-fabrication, then that's how it goes on. And so this problem is also very essential. And when the third unwholesome root, the root of delusion, I've always felt that the most there are several different kinds of delusions, like seeing that something which is impermanent you think is permanent, seeing something that's pleasant and you think it's unpleasant, vice versa, seeing something unpleasant you think it's pleasant. Those are delusions. But the delusion that really is the most dangerous of all is the delusion about the self. So, which, if we have that a belief, that's what is the thing that feeds so many other unwholesome things. Because if we believe in a self, then we're subject to a lot of fear and desire. And so the self-identity, the self-belief, the self-view, then feeds the other two unwholesome roots. And when the self-view breaks, then the other two roots become pointless, and they wither, because there's just nothing. What's it for? What's the desire? And so then, because of that, this kind of consciousness which doesn't have any preferences and which doesn't try to create that continuity over time. When the consciousness without the self-view, then it becomes possible to stop creating that continuity and able to see the momentary arising and subsiding of phenomena. So that's my idea of the significance of this last element. We can see with this part of the teaching that the Buddha has taken quite a different turn. It's like the drift of the teaching has gone into a new room, a new domain. He's at the very beginning we established the awareness of the six senses and the three kinds of feeling and the mental exploration that is arising from that, and then you can see then here, after having done the work with the other elements, we're able to circle back to, in part, to cover on the same theme, except that in this case the mind is no longer running out to explore those objects that are productive of grief and sorrow, but instead the mind is just cognizing them at the state of pleasant or unpleasant or neither. So it's like it's just staying at the barest experience of the feeling, without building anything up about it. So at the beginning of the sutta, we show the tendency of the mind to build something up and to become preoccupied with something based on joy and grief, the somanasa, dhammanasa, the mental pain, the mental displeasure, and now here they're just like the mind doesn't need to do anything about it at all. It just only sees it. There's not any grasping or even any like going out to explore, but instead the mind is simply staying kind of like quietly within its own base of being settled in a way, so there's like a still center point, and the contact and the feelings is happening. It's like coming and going and coming and going, but the mind, you have a very strong sense of the mind being there in the center, in a state of stillness, and that stillness then is what the Blessed One describes as the equanimity. I'm going to read you the next paragraph of the sutta. With this equanimity, he understands, if I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite space and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mine, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. And the commentary would say it would be like many hundreds of or thousands of aeons that the mind would stay in that state. If I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite consciousness, to the base of nothingness, to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and to develop the mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mind supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain there for a very long time. In the Buddhist cosmology, the states of mind associated with the immaterial meditative attainments were like conceived as a kind of a world. So if one is in a certain meditative attainment and you come to the end of this life, well, within that state, then you could exist in a world that has those qualities for so many hundreds of thousands of eons. I mentioned the other day that I'm not emphasizing about or even qualified to teach you how to do the immaterial attainments, but there's a very nice talk by Ajahn Pranadamo about the immaterial attainments. It's the best and clearest that I've ever seen, and it's available on the Dharma Seed if you're interested in that. But here, the Buddha sets this up sort of to knock it down. He said, the meditator understands, if I were to direct this equanimity to the base of infinite space and so on, this would be conditioned. Therefore, he does not form any condition or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being. Since he does not form any condition or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being, he does not cling to anything in this world. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nibbana. He understands thus, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming into any state of being. What we're aiming for then, and I think the way that we could gauge our progress with the effort that we're making in meditation is whatever arises to what degree is the mind got that equanimity to what degree are we forming some kind of identification with this achievement or that achievement? To what degree are we able to have the mind simply be still, simply to cognize the arising and passing away of experiences without trying to do anything, without the pull or the push to do anything about it? So I think this may be enough for tonight's talk. Thank you for your patient listening.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.